Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And we are going to talk about film director John Ford on today's program. And I'm going to let you start us off, Mike, because you are the John Ford expert.
Well, I don't know about that, but I do have a real interest in John Ford's career. He made over 100 movies, and even though he's best known for his westerns, he worked in various genres, and there's some masterpieces along the way there. Just a very long career. One reason I love him in that respect is that he's of a generation of film directors that grew up with the movies. I'm intrigued by this. He was born in 1894. Think about it. This is a generation of directors born in the 1890s or at the dawn of the 20th century as their coming of age, as they're in their late teens, early 20s. Hollywood itself is growing up as an industry, and they enter it one way or another. They enter it, and they almost always rise pretty quickly and work very steadily and have, in many cases, like Ford's, a really long career. I mean, he directs his first movie in 1917 and his last movie in 1966, and he's constantly working, you know, cranking out all those films, strictly 20s. I mean, the pace slows a bit later on, but he's still very prolific there. So anyway, in terms of formative influences, what makes a director what he is, the Irish Catholic background is absolutely essential for understanding John Ford. Number one, because some of those movies, if we look at genres besides the Western, he has those that tap into his Irish heritage, films like The Informer, and even though How Green Was My Valley is set in Wales, the running joke there is that he turned them all Irish, you know, and then, of course, The Quiet Man in 1952. So, I mean, he had a few, like, distinctively Irish films there. And so in terms of the background, it's so quintessentially Irish American, Irish Catholic, that it's when I say stereotypical, I just simply mean that, well, there's an element of truth in a lot of cultural stereotypes. So here goes. Born in 1894, his birth name, Sean Aloysius O'Feeney. He was the 13th and youngest child in an Irish immigrant family in Portland, Maine. Now, his father, whether you believe this or not, you know, being Irish, owned a saloon, right? So everything's matching up this way. You know what I mean? It's just like, yeah, I have to laugh, like, when I read biographies, I'm like, gee, like a checklist, right? Is this guy Irish Catholic or what? You know, and so anyway, he really grows up in that environment. Now, what's crucial for our purposes to get him from the East Coast? He's in that Portland in Maine, to get him there out to Hollywood. What gets him out there, actually, is his older brother, Francis Ford, who was a director and writer and actor, actually quite well known in his day. I have to emphasize that. Nowadays, he's like a footnote to John Ford, but the older brother had gone to Hollywood first. And in fact, it was the older brother who changed the last name. So when John Ford goes out to, you know, live with and be with his brother, and the brother gets him into the movie business, it made sense that, well, you know, this is your brother Francis, and his last name is Ford now, so you become John Ford at that point. And initially, he just did anything in the movies the way people would, entry jobs, you know, gophers and bit acting and so on, assistant directing. Well, one of the great footnotes to that earliest phase was, go all the way back to 1915, that's how early he is out in Hollywood, and John Ford was one of the extras in Birth of a Nation. And not only was he an extra in the Griffith film, but he was one of the Ku Klux Klan riders. Now, I've seen the film a number of times. You'd be hard-pressed to say which white sheet is on top of him, but it's just mesmerizing to think about that one of the great film directors, and it has nothing to do with his political sentiments, because if anything, he was a political liberal in a kind of crusty way. It was just simply, you know, you're a young guy in Hollywood, and you're going from set to set, and they need people on horseback to be extras in this big Griffith picture. So don't read it politically whatsoever, but just simply that, you know, doing a bit of everything in those earliest days, you know, he is among the Klan riding along in at least, you know, a few scenes. There's some debate as to, for some people doubt that it happened, others as to, well, can you spot him? So I'll sort of leave it at that. It's not quite apocryphal, but it's just a sense of the early legends and lore of Hollywood that he evidently was an extra there and did that. Anyway, and not long after that, the story goes that, you know, a director becomes indisposed and needs somebody to fill in. You get tapped that way because you're standing right there. And so 1917 makes his first film. And then, do you want to talk a bit? I mean, I want to talk a bit, but let me hand off at this point in terms of what his career is like, specifically in the 1920s.
Well, I did want to mention that you mentioned three of the movies he won an Academy Award for: The Quiet Man, How Green Was My Valley, and The Informer, the fourth being The Grapes of Wrath.
Grapes of Wrath, yeah. Now, he's notable in that think about how unparalleled this is. In that really long and distinguished career, He won 4 Academy Awards as Best Director. He also won, like many people of his generation in Hollywood, he went into the service in World War II. Didn't have to be drafted, went in. And, of course, you know, like Frank Capra and William Wyler and others, you know, made documentary films. In fact, Capra had the film unit. And Ford, in this case, made a really terrific film called, you know, Battle of Midway, where he was actually holding the camera himself as the battle took place, and the camera shakes, and he's right there to get it. And somebody asked him about that years later in an interview, like how remarkable. And he says, "What's remarkable?" He said, "I was there. That's what they were paying me to do, and I had a camera in my hand, so I turned it on." You know, he won another Academy Award for that. You know, that's sort of a special category. So think about 4 directing Academy Awards throughout that long career, and then, you know, for the World War II documentary, getting yet another Academy Award. And, of course, his films won many other Oscars for other participants that way. But going back to the late teens and through the 20s, he was so prolific. He really cranked out the two reelers and then the feature films and so on. The most important of that, and they're very uneven, but, you know, it's sort of like learn as you go. And of course, Griffith was no different going back to the first 2 decades of the 20th century, where, you know, you just crank them out and enough of them hit and, you know, you kind of get your pace going. But the film that's most significant from that earliest phase, when it was like dozens of films, most of them Westerns, I have to say, most of them Westerns at that point, was The Iron Horse in 1924.
Okay.
It was a commercial and critical success, and it really still plays well. It's a really sharp-looking film. It's a big Western story. And the reason in particular I want to mention, of course, is because of the connection, coincidentally, to Howard Community College. When you look at the college's early history, you know, what was our logo? What was the name of our student newspaper? The Iron Horse. And that, of course, was because of the B&O Railroad's history, you know, founded in Baltimore City, 1827, but by early 1830s, you've got the B&O Railroad Station at the foot of Main Street in Ellicott City. You've got the Thomas Viaduct in Oak Ridge and so on. You've got the railroad pushing through. But whenever I talk about John Ford with my students at Howard Community College, you know, I'll mention, you know, the Iron Horse. And, of course, they're much too young now to remember when that was a valid connection for us at the college. But I always think back to, gee, you know, for most of the college's history, actually, we had a, you know, a moniker, we had a logo, a mascot, if you will, it was a train.
Well, the ironic thing is that, you know, I used to be a student at Howard Community College, and I was the editor of the newspaper, The Iron Horse, for a while.
Yeah.
Small world.
Now, answer me this. I've always wondered, like, some of my students, when I ask them, they recognize the expression Iron Horse all year, the railroad. Some folks, like, you could give 5 guesses and they wouldn't guess it there. But what I'm getting at, in all seriousness, is that in terms of Howard County's strong connection to early railroad history, some of my students really know that. Like, they, not that they've necessarily been docents at the B&O Railroad Museum in Elk City or whatever, or that an older, you know, sibling or a parent, you know, went back to Iron Horse days at HCC. But some of them have a kind of connection where they know that. Other folks, it's just like, you know, it's a history they don't know. And I'm not saying that to make fun in any way. What I'm getting at is John Ford was fascinated with American history. He was very well read, extremely well read. And even though we talk about so many of his films in the 20s and then later in the 40s and 50s being Westerns and into the 60s, I tend to put a broader moniker on that. By that I mean, yeah, he made a lot of Westerns, but there are a number of his films that have Western elements, but they're really films about American history, you know, specifically in the West. But then again, you have like Drums Along the Mohawk, which has been referred to as an Eastern Western. You know, it's upstate New York. And what I'm getting is, as you actually start to look at the Westerns, it's different time periods, the geography varies. He really looks at different aspects of the West and his overall interest in American history. Now, he didn't like to be called an intellectual, and would just scoff at that and so on, but he really was. He was a very smart man and very well read. Correspondingly, he's of that generation of tough guy film directors, my earlier point, who would always insistently talk about themselves as craftsmen. In other words, you know, you turn on the camera, you make the movie. Why'd you put the camera here? Well, it made sense to put it here. Why'd you make that cut? Well, I had a cut, so I cut there. You know, just like no nonsense and kind of gruff. He's not the only one. That generation, William Wellman, Raoul Walsh, these were guys who came into the movies in a kind of rough and tumble way, and they talked about themselves as craftsmen. And in later decades, when film journalists and others would, you know, ask them, you know, pretentious questions about, you know, the auteur theory and you know, what they're trying to do thematically, sometimes they would just stare, like, what are you talking about? You know, I just make movies. And, you know, a quote to that effect was from John Ford, even. I mean, at a meeting of the Directors Guild in 1950, and he actually helped to organize that organization. I mean, the Directors Guild was his creation as much as anything. But at a 1950 meeting, they were going around introducing themselves, and at that point, he's such a famous director, everyone knows who he is, but in his characteristically gruff way, he introduced himself at the microphone by saying, "My name's John Ford. I make westerns." And you know what? You know, that's the attitude he carried. This is gruff, no-nonsense kind of thing. And I mention it at the moment because when you look at the films he made, throughout the career, but we're back in the 1920s still, they're relatively, you know, straightforward. They kick along. They have all kinds of characters and incident and this and that. But you know what? They just keep percolating. They just keep moving along. And there's a lot of film technique there, but characteristically, it doesn't call attention to itself. You know what I'm getting at? Like, if you actually watch them, they're very carefully made, but they don't show off the technique. The technique serves the story and the character. So in the 20s, he's really cranking them out. He's not exactly famous at that point, but he's known, certainly within the industry and with a lot of actors and crew. And that's where he forms his acting company and the troupe, as they're sometimes called. And it's not just actors, but also crew members who stay with him, in many cases, for decades. That's one reason why he's able to crank out so many movies, particularly back in the 20s like that, because you have the same cast and crew in some cases. And, you know, like Harry Carey would work with him a lot in the westerns back then. Years later, Harry Carey Jr. would be in films like The Searchers and so on. You know, you have Olive Carey's in that movie, too. You have entire families of actors who keep working with John Ford. And that gets established, really, and certainly his reputation for making westerns, that gets established very firmly in the 1920s. So even though The Iron Horse is one of the few really great films of his from that decade, there are a lot of others that are just really entertaining. I mean, if you go to the movies every Saturday afternoon to watch the latest western, I mean, that's the stuff you would have been watching, and his were better than most.
Well, he was a very gruff guy. They did ask him in an interview, "So what brought you to Hollywood?" And he said, "The train."
I saw that interview. I know. The other day, I laughed. And in another interview once, he said, "It's no use asking me to talk about art." And that's it. And he was one of the most difficult interviews and really ornery and just really unpleasant, really rude oftentimes. My personal connection isn't to Ford directly. It's before my time. But over the years, I've met Peter Bogdanovich a few times, who's, you know, an estimable filmmaker in his own right, but also as a film historian and scholar, particularly early in Bogdanovich's career. He did a lot of interviews with older directors, and he wrote articles and books about them. And in 1971, Bogdanovich made a documentary film about John Ford called Directed by John Ford, which he later updated, like 2006, with more recent interviews with folks who were still around. But anyway, in that 1971 documentary, which I highly recommend, Bogdanovich does an on-camera interview with John Ford. And Bogdanovich at that point is, you know, a young director and just, you know, full of knowledge about film history and enthusiasm. He asks all of the right questions. And Ford sometimes just stares at him, shrugs, sucks on his pipe, you know, looks off to the side, says something really rude, or along the lines of, you know, "What brought you to Hollywood?" You know, "Train." You know, I mean, I've seen that interview and you know, elsewhere, and there are similar lines in this. It's like one of the most reluctant of interview subjects and one of the rudest, really, just not a pleasant guy there. So I asked Bogdanovich about that once because I wanted to try to figure this out. What was it about John Ford as an interview? And he said, you know, he said Ford was an impossible interview. You wonder why he even agreed to do the interview, because he gives you almost nothing. And this wasn't just like late in life when he was, you know, in poor health and the alcoholism had gotten the better of him, one could say, and the career, you know, it sort of ended. We're not just talking about like those final years, you know, when he'd have reason to be grumpy, but he was a grumpy young man, right? He was never a good interview. I've only seen a few interviews where he really opened up and he really got like a nice chunky quote, you know, something really insightful. Once in a while he would, but most often he just kind of, and I said, well, you know, so I asked Bogdanovich, well, what was your reading of that? I mean, you're sitting there talking to him and he's just not forthcoming. You were asking the right questions and he's brushing them off. And he said, you know, he said, the thing about Ford was he enjoyed being difficult. He liked to, you know, to get people upset. He liked to be a tyrant in some ways. And even the people who worked with him for decades, who loved him, also had reason to hate him. John Wayne talks about this a lot in the Bogdanovich documentary that I mentioned. John Wayne said, you know, that he always had somebody who was at the bottom of the pole, as he put it, sort of like Well, in any given film, there'd be somebody who had either done something that angered Ford or Ford was disappointed in whatever, and suddenly that guy went on the list. You know what I mean? Like, usually an actor, could be a technician, cinematographer. And then throughout the shoot, Ford would just like make jokes about the person, be really gruff with them on the set and openly with other cast and crew around, really demeaning, really derogatory comments. And you know what, ironically, even though John Wayne and John Ford made more than a dozen films together, John Wayne said that he was often the one at the bottom of the list or bottom of the poll. And in fact, I've seen interview quotes where Ford really makes fun of John Wayne in terms of, limited acting ability or this or that or the way he talks. And I think that this is one of the all-time great pairings of director and actor, right? And here's the
Well,
director kind of bad-mouthing him.
why don't we talk about some of his films? And I think one of the most important ones is one that did not win an Oscar and is one of his John Wayne movies, and that is 1939 Stagecoach.
Yeah, look, the thing about Stagecoach, and this is where John Wayne, finally becomes a big movie star. John Wayne had been in movies since about 1930, kind of knocked around. And John Ford knew him from the get. In fact, John Ford helped to get him into movies and so on. So they knew each other. They were friends. Now, to be a friend to John Ford was not an easy thing, but you'd play poker and you'd roughhouse and these are tough guy directors and also tough guy friends. So, but they were friendly and he was a bit of a mentor to him. But anyway, John Wayne on his own had been knocking around through the 1930s, just popping up in various roles, never really establishing himself with the public in the lasting way. That's why in our previous episode here, we had talked about Barbara Stanwyck, where John Wayne has a really bit role in 1933's Babyface. I mean, that's the kind of stuff John Wayne was just anything, Finally, and John Ford, I got to say, having made all those westerns in the 1920s, well, the late 19-teens through the 1920s, having done all that, John Ford basically did not make westerns in the 1930s. It's really remarkable. He's making, not exclusively, but mostly westerns in the 1920s. 1930s, you look down the list, some great movies, all kinds of genres, not the western. But then he returns to the western with Stagecoach in 1939, and because he's known Duke Wayne for almost a decade at that point, he knows that Wayne should play the protagonist. And you know what? That's the movie that made John Wayne a movie star. And it is a great Western, but it really made Wayne's career belatedly. And Wayne retained that rank. I mean, it's always in like the top five actors by way of public recognition and popularity. Wayne retained that from 1939, up to the very end of his career in the early 70s. And it all goes back to Stagecoach. So why don't you tell us some more about Stagecoach?
Well, one thing I wanted to point out for people who are not familiar with John Ford, and especially in all these great John Wayne movies, is if you take a look at Stagecoach or Red River or She Wore a Yellow Ribbon or The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, my favorite Western, or even The Searchers, John Ford never met a natural archway or a doorway that he didn't like. But one of the hallmarks of all of his movies is this kind of framing where he uses the natural framing of a door or an outcropping or something to frame the character. And it's one of those things that is a tell that when you're watching, it's like, how long before we're going to see somebody framed in a doorway?
Well, I've read biographies written by Joseph McBride, and he's one of the great John Ford scholars. And what you're saying is absolutely congruent with one of his observations, that John Ford never met a door frame or a window that he didn't like because it's natural framing for a shot. Just the other night I was watching How Green Is My Valley, and in the opening scene, the opening shot, the principal character is, packing a suitcase and voiceover narration and so on, and then thinking back on his childhood. And as he does that, the camera tracks, and John Ford occasionally would move the camera, not a lot, but when he does, it's for a reason. He moves the camera across the room a little bit to the window, and then it becomes a window onto this character's childhood life. It's really so incredibly moving because you've briefly seen at the very beginning of the film this guy as an adult who's packing up and leaving town, and his narration's telling you why, and then the camera tracks over to the window and moves through the window. When it hits the street, I mean, it's going back to this guy's childhood, and Roddy McDowall will play him as a child, but there's really a sense of like going through a window into another world, an earlier world. And in fact, my favorite John Ford film, and I think one of the greatest westerns, certainly, is The Searchers from 1956. I mean, when people say, what's your favorite western? I can easily answer the searchers, from 1956, unless he asked me on another day, and I might say, well, I really always loved Shane, so there are a few Westerns in Red River, there are a few that I really love, but Shane's near the top of the list, and certainly the searchers. Why do I mention that in context with what you're saying? Well, because the searchers is bookended by the kinds of shots that you're talking about, Marie. At the very beginning of the searchers, somebody, inside the house looks out through the door frame and sees the John Wayne character, Ethan Edwards, riding towards the house. And then, there's a very almost identical shot at the very end of the searchers, again, how it's bookended in terms of after everything that happens in that story, the camera once again is inside the house looking through the open doorway as various characters return home, enter the house, actually walk around to either side of the camera. But meantime, the John Wayne character, being that quintessential Western loner, is on the porch. He could come in too, but instead he puts one hand onto his arm there, which was a spontaneous gesture that Wayne made by way of acknowledging and honoring the memory of Harry Carey. And, in fact, Carey's widow, Olive, was playing a character just the other side of the doorway. She started crying, not as a character, but as a woman. She was crying because she realized the gesture that John Wayne was making to pay homage to her recently deceased husband. But then the Wayne character, having put the hand like that, and that was improvised, Wayne just did that. But having done that, the Wayne character turns and walks away and goes off out into the wilderness, out into the storybooks, the mythology, if you will. And then the door closes, and it's literally closing, on the end of the movie. I mean, the screen goes black at that point. The door is closed. But Maria, it's to your point that when you think about the opening scene and the closing scene in The Searchers and other scenes throughout it, but particularly those two scenes, the whole architecture of the scene, the whole construction of the scene is done with doors and windows. And it's just fascinating and really powerful in a visceral way to use the architecture to frame it like that.
Well, getting back to Stagecoach really briefly, Orson Welles has said that was, he learned everything, there was to know about making movies from watching Stagecoach. And it's interesting that it came out in 39, which is also when Gone with the Wind came out, and that Thomas Mitchell, who plays Scarlett O'Hara's dad, plays the drunken doctor in Stagecoach. And it became one of these tropes where, in fact, lots of stuff from Stagecoach, if you watch it, you'll think, wow, this is just so cliche. It's only cliche because people have copied Stagecoach and over the years.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, because, sometimes I'll show an older film like that and my younger students will say, well, that's so cliched or hackneyed. I said, but something had to be there first to make it a cliche. You know what I mean? Like that, first of all, the Western does tend to be cliched. It's probably the most formulaic of genres. So it's true. Even going back to the teens and 20s, for sure, those cliches are very quickly established. But, cliches often have a sense of life and a verisimilitude, and there's a reason for it. And so when you see a film that's really well made, the elements may be familiar, and yet look how powerfully they're dealt with. And you look at the twists, and you look at the variations and what you can do with those genre conventions that way. But certainly Stagecoach became, one of the most famous Westerns, and how many Westerns before it, had similar stories, one could say, but think about even more so the films after it that sort of owe their strength to a film like that. And it's funny you mentioned Orson Welles, because I was reading about this just the other day, that, Orson Welles was asked once, well, who are the great directors who influenced you, that you look on with great admiration? And Orson Welles said, well, the three are John Ford, John Ford, and John Ford. And yet another Ford connection was, when I mentioned that 1971 documentary film by Peter Bogdanovich, you know what? Guess who the narrator is in that film? It's Orson Welles. Mm. Orson Welles is the narrator throughout that film. And, that was a time when Peter Bogdanovich and Orson Welles were sharing a house back then, and so they were really close friends. And, Welles certainly knew Ford from way back when. But Welles has said that when he was making Citizen Kane, he was thinking about various aspects of John Ford's career. I mean, they're very different as filmmakers, but one of the things he thought about, and it's a connection between Welles and Ford, is when you have the camera stationary and you have a shot that's like a medium to medium long shot, it's okay sometimes to let the action play out in the frame. You know, and particularly when Welles was working with Greg Toland, the cinematographer, with that fabulous deep focus cinematography, you know, you can see detail in the distance. Have a few characters in the foreground, a few in the background, have people entering and exiting the frame, hold it that way. Welles does that, you know, brilliantly throughout Citizen Kane. And you know what? When you watch the John Ford films that we're talking about, I mean, The Searchers and any number of the films we're talking about, how oftentimes the camera sits there and Ford's attitude is, why move it if you don't have to? I mean, you know, think, you know, not that you're being like stagey in a static sense, but think about how you can, he's one of the masters of composition. That's how it's put. That, you know, you've got a frame to fill.
I'm glad you said that because I'd like to pivot over to The Searchers for a minute and mention
okay.
that for those of you out there who are going to watch for the first time. There's a moment of, now where have I seen that before, in that there's a scene where John Wayne comes across a devastated village.
Oh, yeah.
And this has actually been recreated in Star Wars, same scene with Luke Skywalker. That and the fact that when The Searchers came out, there's a tagline that John Wayne keeps saying, is, that'll be the day. And Buddy Holly and his band members to go to the movies that, you know, one day, saw the movie and wrote that song, That'll Be the Day, after seeing The Searchers. So,
well, you know what? Years ago, I went to hear George Lucas speak in Washington, and he was asked a lot about Star Wars, as you'd expect, and what were the influences on it. And he acknowledged, you know, Akira Kurosawa, you know, films like Hidden Fortress, and that the Princess Leia figure, you know, is derived from a Kurosawa character. And, you know, it was interesting to listen as Lucas explained that. You know, he was a film buff, and that film from the late 50s, you know, really influenced him. And the second film that I'm recalling at the moment was when he mentioned The Searchers. He said, you know, enough of you people, you know, here in the audience are, you know, grew up watching, you know, the Star Wars films, and you know scenes as well as anybody. And, you know, the scene from The Searchers, he said he absolutely was thinking about that, you know, and it was like, you know, an inside reference, an homage. I mean, he didn't do it thinking, you know, he wants audiences to pick up on this. But for him personally, on a very private level, he had so much respect for The Searchers, he wanted to work in that sort of reference. Whereas the Kurosawa influence is a bit more pervasive in the sense that, you know, you're going to have a character, you know, directly derived from a Kurosawa character. The Searchers reference is more of what I call sort of a one-off thing there. However, it's more than just one-off, because the direct reference is one-off. So there's that scene in The Searchers, and here's how he uses it in Star Wars. But oftentimes when people discuss Star Wars, and I do this myself, they talk about it as a Western set in outer space.
Yep.
And so there's that broader thematic connection between them.
Yeah, so it's a space western, actually, when you think
about it. Absolutely. Well, I like to use metaphors in this sense. If you think about the settlement of the United States, that westward expansion, manifest destiny, and so on, people oftentimes refer to that using what essentially is a horizontal metaphor, you know, as you push from the East Coast to the West Coast. Once the West Coast has been reached and the Census Bureau in 1890 officially declares the frontier to be closed, well, we keep pushing westward. That's the very point where with the Spanish-American War, for instance, we go over as far as the Philippines. You know, you keep pushing horizontally. But once you've pushed about as far as you can horizontally, what's next? Well, so once the frontier has been declared closed, here's President Kennedy in the early 1960s referring to the new frontier, which is, you know, specifically, among other things, the space program. So you then at that point go from a horizontal metaphor to a vertical metaphor, because Kennedy, in one of his most famous speeches, talks about his determination to see Americans reach the moon by the end of the decade. So, you know, again, in terms of that American spirit and reaching out, you've gone horizontally, now you go vertically.
You know, you really can't help but get a little bit of American history when you're watching any sort of John Ford movie. And that pretty much brings us to the end of our time for this segment. But be sure to check us out on the internet at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.